And there was a chance that they could have said, hey, at this time, we need you to put in sprinkler systems. That would have taken us out, right? If we didn't potentially have the working capital. But for those that don't think that's a necessity, you can't control sometimes what happens during the transitional phase.
Welcome to the Before You Buy or Sell a Business podcast, where we help buyers and sellers learn more about the acquisition process, discuss recent transactions, and stay up to date on the latest news in the market. Here's your host, Jared Johnson.
All right. Today on the podcast, I have Dan Cox, who bought a restaurant. Happy to talk to you today about the process, and hopefully we can find some good information for anybody looking to buy a business. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Of course. Yeah, no problem. So maybe we can talk about how we met each other. I was trying to remember, and I want to say that your partner, I had done a loan for him, but maybe we'll make sure that that's the case.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we were working on a couple different opportunities. And ultimately, he suggested my partner had worked with you in the past. And we decided to switch gears and contact you to seek out this new opportunity that we had come across.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, that happens from time to time, of course, where, you know, you start with one bank or maybe, you know, trying to work with a seller to do seller financing and then end up having to shift gears. So, you know, being flexible always helps. Maybe we can talk first about your background. Maybe tell us where you grew up, if you went to college, where you went, you know, any of that fun stuff for us.
Yeah. So I'm a Southern Utah guy and grew up here down close to the St. George, Utah area, which is close to Las Vegas, about 2 hours away. So we're right down in the corner in the desert area of Utah. And so we don't get all that great snow that Northern Utah gets. Grew up in a little town called Hurricane, or how we like to pronounce it, Hurricane. And spent my whole childhood in this area, went to high school here, played sports here. There's a local community college that I attended at first for my associate's degree, and then moved away. And when I came back, it had switched to a university. And so I ended up with a bachelor's at a university in the same school. And so spent a lot of time down here in Southern Utah growing up and going to school.
So what'd you do when you got out of school? What was kind of your first career move at that point?
Well, I started in construction, started a business in construction, doing subcontracting work in the fencing industry. And I built that business for some time and moved on from it into the health and wellness industry, where I took over a local gym, a local health facility and fitness facility, and was their general manager for some time. And that was really early in my 20s. So that was kind of nerve-wracking to step into that particular organization that had, 3,000 members, I think, signed up for its club, and lots of different employees. And then I walked in at, oh man, how old was I? 23 years old, maybe around that age, and was going to take over as the general manager. And the staff was a little bit hesitant, rightfully so. I was hesitant myself. And that was probably my first experience at a larger organization or operation. And I spent some time managing that and ultimately ended up leaving to pursue a career in law enforcement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe let's dive into that real quick.
Yeah. So that was a little bit of a transition. I was looking for maybe a different opportunity that would take me out of Southern Utah. Okay. And so I started looking into different careers, and ultimately had a family member who was working in the Utah Department of Corrections. So a large statewide agency. And I thought to myself, well, I could go anywhere in the state and this would be a good opportunity to have a stable career. So I sought that out, was able to get hired and move through their training and their academy, and ended up starting my employment with them in the prisons. So I worked up in the prisons in Northern Utah, and it was a short time, and I was able to promote and transfer out, or like I like to say, I got my parole date and I paroled out of prison. And I was able to move on to community supervision because the Department of Corrections just has so much opportunity. It's a large organization. It's got prisons. It has workforces. It has treatment centers. It has community supervision, investigation arms. And so it's got, in my opinion, it's just a little bit broader in what you can do versus just a local, maybe a local PD. And again, that's just my opinion. Local PDs and those guys might have great opportunities. But I was able to promote out, spent some time in Northern Utah as a probation and parole officer. And then over the course of time, had a chance to come back into Southern Utah. And I spent about 7 years just going through lots of different channels of the organization, which I felt was really great for me. It was a good chance to get well-rounded. I explored what it looked like to start programs and oversee programs. I was able to lead different pilots and programs inside of the state. And so it was feeding in a way, which I wasn't aware of, it was feeding still my entrepreneurial spirit by letting me kind of hop through different opportunities and grow my capacity to lead and to explore and to innovate and create. But ultimately ended up going into the true entrepreneurial world about seven, eight years after starting with the Department of Corrections.
Well, I'm sure you learned a lot, working in that world. You kind of learn how to talk to people. You learn how to handle different personalities, different situations. So I think a lot of people kind of don't understand, although it is fairly probably taxing mentally, you're learning so much on how to deal with every kind of situation that it really prepares you for running a business. And so it's probably a pretty good, base for you to gain by doing that. You mentioned, St. George, Southern Utah. I love that area. It's so pretty. I've got some good friends that live out that way. And anytime I can get out there, I'm happy to go say hi to everybody and check it out, especially when, it's kind of more in the spring where it's kind of transitioning from winter to summer. You get some good weather and it's still real pretty with some snow in the mountains and stuff. So good place to grow up. So I know ultimately, I believe you kind of went into, if I remember correctly, more of like the assisted living type industry. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you brought up something about how parole and probation probably taught me or was a great training ground for me. And I really kind of gravitate to that statement. I recently actually did a TEDx talk and gave TEDx talk in January. And I spoke exactly to what you just mentioned, where probation and parole work was so rich in its diversity of opportunities and challenges that the way that I utilized that was to take the skills, and I speak about this in my TEDx talk, take the skills that I was learning and find a way to energize those or enhance those to transition into entrepreneurial work. And that transition was what you just mentioned. I ended up transitioning still inside of Health and Human Services. Probation and parole, Department of Corrections is all about rehabilitation and helping people. So it's a kind of a human service kind of element to it. And I continued that same exploration into the entrepreneurial world. So I was taking the skills being developed over here and looking for opportunities to transition out of it, and found that space inside of the health industry or mental and behavioral health industry. So I didn't quite go into skilled nursing. I went into a psychiatric residential type adolescent programming. Okay. And was able to start a few facilities in that industry. And I worked that for about 5.5 years until I exited in 2021.
Cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very diverse background, but like, as you mentioned, and I'll have to definitely look up your TED talk. It sounds like you kind of connected the dots. I feel like I do that a lot when I'm talking to buyers, right? Sometimes they come to me and they say, mm-hmm. I don't have direct industry experience. And I say, well, tell me what you have done. And we'll kind of go through and, you know, piece by piece of what they've done over their career. And by the time we're done talking, they kind of realize, oh, I actually did set myself up for this. I just didn't really realize that maybe I didn't work specifically in that industry. So, you know, I think it's kind of a good transition. You bought a restaurant, right? Those are not always the easiest thing in the world to run. And banks don't always love making loans to people that are buying restaurants that didn't grow up in the restaurant world. So I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit, but maybe you could give me an idea how you found this listing.
Yeah. So as I said, I ended up selling those hospitals. So we had a large organization, you know, close to 300 employees, or just over 200, and growing at the time that we sold. But in the combination of all our businesses, we had quite a few employees across the portfolio. And we sold that in 2021, and we were trying to assist in the transition in a passive kind of removed way as we watched them continue to try to stabilize it. But in 23, the beginning of 2023, I just kind of was starting to get stir crazy. You know, there wasn't a lot going on. I wasn't doing anything. I had no control over that organization that we had sold. I had no staff members or direct reports. And I was thinking, this is kind of boring waking up every day. And just started the search, basically. I reached out to a broker, said, hey, I'd love to find an opportunity out there where I could re-engage again and do something. And so we started looking at tons of opportunities across the entire United States, and a lot of them just didn't work out, you know. And you know this, by the time you get into the due diligence, just something doesn't quite click, or the numbers don't work, and you have to step away from that opportunity. And I wasn't looking for a restaurant. That wasn't the objective. My criteria was just wanted something, of course, like probably anybody would wanted a cash flowing, stable type of organization that I could just step into and potentially keep it going or enhance it. And it didn't matter what industry that was in, but ultimately it ended up being a restaurant.
So yeah, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. A lot of people I talk to will come to me from various, you know, sources or referral sources saying, hey, this individual is looking to buy a business. They need some information about SBA lending. And so I usually, you know, kind of get with them, try to talk to them. And a lot of times they're maybe 3 to 6 months into searching for a business. And most of the time, I feel like at that point, they're starting to get a little tired, a little burned out. And I usually tell them, hey, just so you know, most people don't find a business right away. They're searching for sometimes 2-3 years before they really find exactly what they're looking for. And I always try to remind them, try not to go away from, you know, kind of your thesis or what you're looking for just because you're tired. So I try to not relate it this way, but a lot of times it's like dating. I've seen friends or other individuals that, you know, maybe a year or two into kind of dating people, but not having a good relationship, almost say, I don't care who the next person is. I want to settle because I don't want to be alone. And so we try to tell them the same thing with a business. Don't just settle. Don't just, you know, ignore some red flags just because you're tired of searching. So I'm glad you brought that up. So on this listing, what were some of the things that you liked right away that kind of kept you interested and still looking at it?
It's time, right? It was a long-standing organization, 25 years. So it had been around for quite some time. So that was something I wanted, that type of history behind it, and the staff tenure as well. In a couple of the different opportunities that looked into, I felt like the staff tenure was too short, like their turnover time was way too short. Their management was too inexperienced. This one, 90% of the staff members, which there's about 25 of them. So, you know, a good portion of these staff members had been with this organization for 15 years or more. And wow. I don't think you find that very often. So that was the biggest hook, I would say, that got me, you know, at the beginning stages.
So. Yeah, that's great. And you bring up an excellent point. Paying attention to the tenure of the employees will really give you an idea of kind of how they've been treated, how happy they are. And then also, how much do they know about the business? How much are they going to help you? Are you going to be able to just walk in the door and hit the ground running? So sounds like you know, after a long search, you kind of found that right piece of the business you were looking for. So do you remember what it was listed for?
1.2.
Okay. So I believe that was what you ended up settling on. So was there any kind of negotiations back and forth?
No, we didn't do any major. I think the evaluation was good. It might have been lower than what maybe it could have been. And so by the time we went through the books, we had a forensic accountant, which, I mean, sounds fancy, but I mean, just a guy that was super detailed. Mm-hmm. And he went through the books. Everything just looked really great. There wasn't a need to really beat them up a lot on the price. And so we didn't do a lot of that. We had a little bit of a seller note, just kind of as a way to get the seller more invested in the process. But it wasn't a huge one. I think we only did like a $35,000 seller note. So it wasn't crazy at all.
Yeah. You know, and I get that question kind of a lot. Do you require a seller note? Do you have to have a seller note? And most of the time I tell people, if it benefits you, whether that's because it's a cheaper interest rate or maybe a longer term, or there's some kind of benefit there that's going to be cheaper, that's going to end up freeing up some cash flow rather than the traditional debt, or even putting in more cash gives you the opportunity to hang on to your liquidity, then go for it. It also, at the end of the day, helps keep the seller engaged. And, you know, being that it was smaller, you know, $35,000 is definitely a smaller note, but it kind of gives you a little bit of a range with the seller to see, okay, are they going to just say, okay, no problem? Or are they going to say, absolutely not, I don't want to carry anything, which could potentially make you feel a little nervous that are they just trying to cut and run, right? And so we want to try to avoid that. So I think you did a good job kind of meeting in the middle. You didn't go with a huge amount that would run the seller off, but then you also still had something there that ultimately benefited you in a couple different ways. So I believe then also you had some inventory included. And then I think we included about $75,000 in working capital, which was, you know, to kind of help make sure that you hit the ground running. So when you're thinking back on the negotiations and, you know, moving forward in the structure, if a buyer asked you, hey, how should I handle that process and that part of the transaction, what do you think you would tell them?
It's a good way to gauge where the seller's at, right? So you throw a seller note out and you see how much resistance is there. It could be a really critical strategic move. For me, it was a strategic move in a little bit of a way too, because this restaurant is on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. I'm on the West Coast, right? And having that buyer a little bit more engaged, the word, you know, when I use the word engaged, I'm looking for him to be interested in its long-term success so that he can, you know, potentially get that seller note back to him. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, I could see that, and it has worked, you know, he's shown a lot of interest. How are things going? Can I help with the transition anymore? And so if I were talking to somebody that's looking at that, I think you should always explore, for the most part, you should always explore a seller's note just to see where that seller is and if you need that engagement or you don't need that engagement. Or as you said, are they trying to dump it and run? What is their sentiment towards this business? How much confidence do they have in it to either accept or not accept that? And so working over that's really important. As you said, now on the other side, do you need it for cash flow? Do you need it for a lower interest rate? Those are all elements that you have to be moving around when you're looking at this deal before you settle on it. And you're running those numbers. And ultimately, even though we did a small $35,000 note, it really didn't move the needle a lot when it came to, you know, interest or lowering the debt, or it was more of an engagement element for us. But in a lot of ways, people use it for exactly what you said, more for the financial piece.
Yeah. And then also keep in mind, so at that time period was when the SBA was making quite a bit of changes. So they had allowed it to count towards your down payment if it was on standby for least 24 months. So you were able to put in less than 10% because of that note. So that's another option. Lets you keep your capital, puts you in a good spot. All right, so you got the contract done, you agreed on a structure, purchase price. You kind of already mentioned a little bit of having a CPA kind of run through the numbers. Was there anything else you did during due diligence? And during that period, did anything come up that made you nervous at all?
So every opportunity that I looked in, I would say that most people might find this intuitive, but during the due diligence phase, I went out and spent time at the actual location in the facility. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to just get your eyes on it. I would assume that most people do that, but during that due diligence phase, you can sit and look at numbers all day. You can, you know, assume what that looks like, but numbers most of the time will tell you the full story, but laying eyes on the physical location, talking to the staff, maybe that's incognito, you know, where they don't know because you're trying not to tip the organization over by tipping them off that there might be a sale pending. But just being around them, looking at how the operation is going without them treating you differently is really an important piece, in my opinion, to go spend some time doing. So that was a part of the due diligence phase, was that time spent at the physical location, watching the operations in real time.
Yeah, that's some great advice. We definitely see people that maybe just so, hey, yeah, the numbers look great, let's move forward. And then I think ultimately, even if you are comfortable with all of that and you do a site visit or you spend some time there, spend some time with the seller, you're also going to be able to put yourself in a good position once you take over the business because you've kind of seen how it operates. Mm-hmm. And you're able to just, you know, you're more familiar with it when you walk in. You're not walking in going, okay, I've got to learn everything here real quick. So,
oh yeah.
So obviously, I mean, I guess I would say nothing really kind of was a red flag for you at that point during due diligence.
No, nothing came up that, great. You know, the numbers were great. Things looked great. No major red flags. Like the previous six or seven different opportunities had red flags. Yeah. But this one just really was looking great and had a lot of potential.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, all right. Well, I mean, yeah, we were happy we were able to get the loan approved, you know, the structure that you needed. So one thing we haven't talked about too much on the podcast, and I think it'd be great to discuss is, so we did build in some working capital. So maybe mm-hmm. you could kind of explain taking over the business from, you know, the very first day on, what kind of things did you have to spend your working capital on?
Yeah, the first few weeks and months, things change when you go. It depends on what industry you're in, but even in the restaurant industry, there's regulatory bodies. Hmm. We've got health inspectors who are issuing licenses. We have alcohol. There's the city fire business. There's regulators in pretty much probably most industries for sure, and I think that, at least in my experience, watching a sell and a transition two or three times now, it seems as if the regulators use this opening as a way to up their game a little bit, right? Or, you know, where they were comfortable with the previous owner and operations and they were just kind of up renewing and moving forward as if nothing was changed. I saw that when we first took over, it seemed as my previous experience had been that the regulators were like, great, this is a great opportunity to make them change this and update that and fix this. And so those first 2 months were repair after repair, trying to meet the demands of the regulators that were coming in. And it was a little bit frustrating. It was really time consuming because initially you want to come in and continue to find opportunities to increase the operations and support it. And you find yourself putting in a tile or, you know, changing out shelving that you weren't wanting to do. But we lost quite a few months and utilized that working capital though to get the energy moving in that direction. And it also allowed for some staffing decisions, right? Where we could maybe bump somebody's salary just a little bit to get them to take on more strategic roles that could help the organization. We looked at the working capital for the biggest thing, I would say, was we had to determine, even though this organization had been around for 25 years, it was being operated out of the mind of the owner. So it lacked a lot of modernization. It lacked technology. And so we spent quite a bit of working capital around researching what it would look like to bring in different technologies and stack those to support and elevate the operations to set it up to grow, hopefully, here in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. So there was a big tax deck kind of research and implementation, and we're still implementing new technology right now in the organization, and it's been, you know, 6-7 months now. So that was a big lift that we took on at the initial phases, as well as exploring that side of things.
Yeah, thanks for shining light on it. That was a great answer. I tend to get some decent pushback from buyers time to time saying, hey, I don't need that much working capital. I don't need the working capital. So I'm glad you're able to kind of explain, you know, what all goes into taking over the business. And oftentimes it's not something you're thinking about. You had mentioned the regulators kind of looking at it as an opportunity to make changes and kind of look at it and say, hey, I've got this like kind of one chance to get this stuff updated. And I often see that with landlords as well. They often look at it and go, well, I've got one chance to change the lease agreement and I can charge this and that, up the rent. They you know, kind of almost try to take advantage of the situation because they know if the lease agreement doesn't get transferred or they don't accept the buyer, then the deal's dead. And so unfortunately you kind of see it go that way, but I'm glad you were able to kind of manage through that. And, you know, you had the working capital that was needed to be successful.
I think, like you said, for those that don't think that it's necessary, you can't control some of those elements there. Even in this transition, there was a chance that the fire department was going to say, cause this building was kind of older, and there was a chance that they could have said, hey, at this time, we need you to put in sprinkler systems. That would have taken us out, right? If we didn't potentially have the working capital. Luckily, we were able to avoid that. But to take a 6,000, 7,000 square foot building and sprinkler the whole thing, that's a big, heavy lift. You know, they even talked about making us pour new concrete and change our exits and regresses. And those are things that you didn't expect, but if you didn't have that working capital, the stress level would have been, you know, even that much higher. Luckily, we negotiated through those and we were able to work around it. But for those that don't think that's a necessity, you can't control sometimes what happens during the transitional phase.
Yeah, that's definitely some great advice. And I would assume your background helped a little bit in negotiating some of that stuff. So it puts you in a good spot. Having good business experience and then understanding kind of how things should be and how they should go. Even if you didn't specifically operate a restaurant, you had food service in your business, so you kind of understood some of the regulations and stuff. So it's always good for a buyer to really pay attention to kind of what's in their wheelhouse too when they're looking at taking over a business.
Yeah, like you said, I didn't have restaurants. I mean, we had huge food service operations in our health facilities. They weren't as public facing, and there's different dynamics for sure of having a public facing kind of concept, dining concept that's in the community versus just running a food service department inside of an organization. But to what you're speaking to, I was very familiar with regulations around food services. I knew how to deal with those licensing elements to it, ordering inventory, managing that, putting together staffing schedules, making sure that we're outputting the food to meet the demand of what we had to meet. And those were all pieces that I was able to leverage. Now, there's a learning gap that I had to take on, which is what does it look like to have the community find interest in our unique dining concept? And make sure that that experience is exceeding what they expect from us. And overall, though, if, as you said at the very beginning stages, don't shut the door on opportunities because you don't think that you potentially can handle those. Look at your skills that you've had from every previous experience and find a way to see how those are able to be enhanced to meet this new opportunity potentially.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. So maybe shifting gears a little bit. So just maybe kind of a quick idea. So the SBA process is not the easiest thing in the world. You know, you've been through it. If there was something you could say about that process to a buyer, maybe so they could prepare themselves for it, what would be kind of maybe one or two things you would advise them on?
Yeah, that one's a good one, Jared. I think that mainly what you're hoping to achieve when you're looking at the opportunity of either SBA or self-funding or whatever that opportunity might be, you're constantly looking at what are the complexities of this particular opportunity and what are the financial needs to buying or succeeding in buying this particular organization. The SBA loan process, it may seem daunting, but if you have a lot of careful planning and you have a lot of strategic preparation, it can be a very manageable and even like really empowering experience is what I mean to say there. There's a lot of probably key steps that you want to take when you look at the SBA process. You need to spend a lot of time understanding it, of course. So step one would be get in there, either bump shoulders with you as the potential loan officer and ask them to educate you or familiarize yourself with the types of businesses that are eligible for an SBA loan. What are the size standards? What are the specific financial criteria that SBA loans need for you know, an application? And just ensure that you're making sure you're meeting those criteria elements and avoid any surprises that might come up down the line. For sure, you would want to make sure that you have a comprehensive plan. What is the business plan at the end of the day to achieve an SBA loan approval? And you're refining that plan. As a new opportunity comes, you have to adapt that particular plan because you are looking for the SBA to evaluate this particular opportunity and say there is definitely a chance that this will succeed. There's a minimization of risk because you've done your market analysis, you've done your financial projections, you've outlined a really clear picture of what it looks like of how you would use that loan. So don't go into the SBA loan process assuming that they're just going to hand you money. You should be doing a lot of that market research. You should be looking for the viable path to profitability, I think, is the biggest thing. On a personal side, and Jared, you know this from my world, because I was a serial entrepreneur, my financial picture was more complex, I would say. And so before you enter in, and if I were to look back, I would probably do a little bit better job getting organized, and maybe you'll tell me I did fine. But organizing your financial statements that you have in your personal finances and your previous business finances is going to speed up the process. You have to put together, they want a lot of information and they need to know what your financial picture looks like. And so come to the table ready to provide that with your previous tax returns, with profit and loss statements and balance sheets and all of the things that they're going to need to look at to review your personal finances and your financial statements. And that will aid you in that SBA loan process. There's a ton of other things, of course, that you could do, like make sure you have great credit, that you're paying your debt and you're preparing yourself to enter into a loan with the SBA, that you have all your documentations ready, that you're seeking advice from people that have been down this road, that you're also prepared if you personally don't have an avenue to a down payment. Mm-hmm. You don't have seasoned money, as they would like to say, right? In the bank account for the opportunity that you're looking at, whether that's 10% down payment or 20%, then you need to start exploring partnering with people that can leverage that, well, not leverage, but can meet that obligation. And then you spoke to this. I think with anything, you've got to maintain a lot of patience, a lot of persistence, because the SBA process is not super fast. It's lengthy. It requires that patience. It requires that persistence. And I think by taking a lot of those steps, you can become a really strong candidate for an SBA loan, and you can move closer to successfully purchasing and growing a business that you're interested in.
That was perfect. Yeah. And I mean, you did bring up, you know, making sure you've got your, you know, financial situation kind of, I wouldn't say in order, but maybe just a little easier to grab items and send over. And I think that was a great thing that not a lot of people talk about. You were fine. I think the more of the issue becomes, are you willing to put it together? Are you willing to, mm-hmm. you know, quickly grab what you need and get it over to, you know, an underwriter or, you know, the bank, because that's what they want to look at. The challenge we often face is somebody says, well, I own 6 companies and I just sold one and I just bought another one and I've got this and I got that. I don't want to do this. Like, I have to have my accountant go through everything and stuff. Mm-hmm. So when we get the question of how long will this take, it's usually where I'll kind of put it back on them. Well, how quickly will you get me what you need? So, you know, you did a great job providing us what was needed. And I appreciated you kind of understanding why we needed it and what it was for. So, yeah, that was a great answer. So how's the business doing now?
Yeah, I think overall it was good. The transition was good. We're stabilizing that. A lot of the staff members that were chosen to take on a little bit more responsibility have done great in transitioning into those roles. Again, like I mentioned, this is an East Coast restaurant and I'm a West Coast based guy. And so that element of making sure staff could take on the role of management was really crucial. And I think everything has gone really well in that transition. We've launched a lot of supportive elements when it comes to managing and supporting operations. One of the things that I took on somewhat early in my entrepreneurial world was the exploration of how important operating systems are. Mm-hmm. And I had implemented an operating systems. When I say that, I mean, how do you execute things? How do you communicate inside of an organization? There's a lot of great programs out there. We decided to use a program called Bloom Growth. It is a software-based company, but since they have launched their coaching side of what they do with organizations that are looking for opportunities for their leadership teams to grow in their capacity of operating and managing. And that, so when you ask, how are things going? That was really critical in my mind, is to walk into that organization and make sure that the leadership staff had an operating system of how do they get things done and how do they communicate? Because without that, we couldn't find a way to grow very well. We were going to just stay stagnant. Mm-hmm. And that's been really great to watch the staff members adopt that operating system. And I do that with a lot of organizations. I go in and coach them. So I have quite a few coaching clients that I'm coaching their C-suite arm of the company, and I'm sitting down with their leadership team and we're going over these critical pieces. And I feel without doing that, then my answer to this question would have been like, oh, it's all right. We're just trying to figure it out. But we're not just kind of trying to figure it out. We're pretty intentional in what we're doing. And we're hopeful that the market will support the efforts that we're looking to take on, mm-hmm. and continue to find ways to grow. Things always get thrown at you. So how it's going right now is, of course, inflation snuck up on us really fast. I think we mm-hmm. bought right when it was starting to heat up a little bit. And our prices and our expenses have increased. And that's something that we have to continue to figure out how to change and adapt and work through. And those were things that we didn't expect to take on, which is another great reason to have working capital, is you don't know when your expenses are going to jump on you. So I think it's been great to spend time with the leadership team, implement an operating system, and also continually have discussions around what is the market doing to us and how are we adjusting? So it's been a great experience so far, and we continue to navigate it. So
yeah, it's great. Great to hear. And you kind of hit the nail on the head. If you don't have a plan, you don't have experience, and you don't really kind of see the vision moving forward, you're going to struggle. So it's great to hear that. So what's next?
For the restaurant, we're going to continue to grow it, right? Uh-huh. We're looking for the goal within the next 5 years. We want to have 3 locations in North Carolina is where cool. we're looking to go next. And we're looking for a lot of growth opportunity for the current staff. And so as far as what the restaurant industry looks like, that's where we're going next, is just continuing to find opportunities to grow that brand and support the staff members along the way. For me, of course, I'm still a serial entrepreneur. So I'm going to look for more opportunities, spend more time looking at maybe the purchase of a new company. I really enjoy the coaching that I do right now. That's actually its own company. We're constantly pursuing opportunities to roll up my sleeve with leadership teams and help them to figure out how to grow as well. So that's, for me, that's kind of where I'm at. Want to grow the current restaurant, want to look for maybe some different opportunities, and want to continue to coach other teams.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, hopefully we can help you out with that. Keep in mind, one of the new changes with SBA was if you go into a different industry, so a different NAICS code, you can actually get another $5 million in SBA funding. So keep that in mind when you're out looking, and be happy to help you out however we can.
Oh yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I always ask 2 questions at the end, and this has been great. And I'm sure you'll nail these 2 questions as well, but, do you have a mentor, or have you ever had a mentor?
So I have a mentor, kind of leading into the point behind a mentor. I think that especially when you're going into an industry that maybe you're not comfortable with, or you're transitioning to a different phase in your life, you have to have a mentor. Every great coach needs a coach. And that's kind of what I would speak to, is you're looking to be able to call somebody and ask for support, and to know that you can lean on somebody to get answers that maybe you're not looking, or you don't know how to get at that exact moment. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things inside of business that not only do you need the practical answers, but sometimes you need the emotional answers too. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
And I think maybe some people overlook the value of a mentor in that way. Running a business can be really difficult. It can be emotionally taxing, and you're trying to figure out ways to navigate all of those different elements of it. And one of the things that I would say that is really profound for me is that the impact of a mentor in business is what propelled my growth both professionally and personally. So there's 2 elements of a mentor. You're going to get some professional help as well, but the personal is going to happen as well. I don't know if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the main reason I asked the question is, you know, have you relied on it? Do you feel like it's necessary? So I appreciate you answering that way. So last question, you've been very successful. You've kind of navigated several different career paths, and been successful at all of them. But what motivates you?
For me, I would say that a lot of the things that I'm motivated by is the concepts that I call holistic success, right? There's, in my opinion, there's this kind of element that you don't have to just look at financials to be successful, but you have, so it goes beyond financial gain, but what motivates me is personal fulfillment, the well-being of my team. As I mentioned, I sold my businesses, and what got me to want to go and buy another one is that I enjoy being around a team and finding ways to increase their well-being. So there's a personal fulfillment side, but there's the well-being of a team that's really important to me. Positive impact on community, on maybe society at a large, is really critical. And businesses provide your opportunity to have more resources, so that you could potentially take on projects that you're really passionate about that might help you achieve broader goals. And that's a big motivator to be an entrepreneur, is to be able to have that opportunity to do that and to collaborate and to be innovative. The entrepreneurial world is very innovative. You get to explore, you get to have a lot of failures, and you get to have some successes. And that innovation process is really engaging to continue to learn, to continue to adapt. These are all just the ebb and flows of entrepreneurship. And that's what continues to kind of pull you in, is this empowerment and this personal development side of the entrepreneurial world, so that you can hopefully continue to find ways to make an impactful, you know, social impact, I guess you could say, a positive social impact, and benefit maybe personally in your own growth along the way.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I often ask the question just to try to kind of get inside and understand, you know, what's really pushing you. So yeah, that was a great answer. So really appreciate all of the amazing golden nuggets we're going to be able to pull out of this. I'm hoping, you know, the listeners will be able to find a lot of good advice. So you had mentioned in the beginning the TED Talk. Do you know where we could find that if somebody wants to be able to look for it?
Yeah, so it's on TEDx's YouTube channel. You know, they have there's about 40 million subscribers on that. They're a huge nonprofit organization. But if you go and you just search my name, you could say Dan Cox TEDx Talk. It's called Elevating Expertise: How Skill Synergy Shapes Success.
I will definitely go check that out right now. And I'm sure we can put it in the notes as well. So yeah, really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, we will definitely, I'm sure, talk soon as you continue to push yourself through this entrepreneurial journey. And anything we can do to help, let me know.
Yeah, will do. Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this podcast informative and helpful. Please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. For more information, or if you'd like to discuss a transaction, please go to www.jaredwjohnson.com.